The murder of Dean O'Banion turned out to be John Torrio's last great achievement in Chicago. He left the city soon after the funeral and, with his wife Anne, began a long and leisurely tour of vacation spots in the American South and the Caribbean. They visited Hot Springs, Arkansas, which was a favorite gangland recreation spot in the 1920s that probably deserves an episode all its own, but anyway, they then moved on to New Orleans, Havana, the Bahamas, Palm Beach, and St. Petersburg. Torrio wasn't just having a nice vacation, though. He was staying away from the tensions that were undoubtedly heating up in Chicago. But little did he know, Chicago trouble was on his trail. He didn't realize that his trip with Anne was keeping him just one step ahead of gunmen that had been dispatched by Jaime Weiss to kill Torrio whenever they got the chance. To Jaime's regret, they never caught up with him. The killers always seemed to arrive a day or two late and a few times only missed them by a few hours. Torrio's hastily arranged vacation caused him to miss what turned out to be the Chicago underworld social event of the season, a Genoa wedding. On January 10, 1925, Angelo Guetta married Lucille Spignola, the sister of a leading Chicago attorney, Henry Spignola. An invitation to the reception was published in newspapers, inviting the entire city to the Ashland Auditorium, and more than 3,000 people packed into the venue. It was a grand celebration centered around a wedding cake that was so massive it took 6 men to carry into the auditorium, and the party went on all night. One of the honored guests at the wedding and the wild reception that followed was, of course, Al Capone. But Al wasn't there alone. He spent the evening with many of his most loyal bodyguards nearby, ready to step in and take a bullet that might be intended for the boss. Capone wasn't taking any chances. Rumor was that assassins were following him everywhere he went, including to the church for the wedding and to the reception that followed. But if this rumor was true, the killers didn't decide to strike until 2 days later, when the first shots were fired in the war that would soon consume the city. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of America. And welcome to our latest season, Murder City. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, we're taking you to Chicago in the Roaring Twenties, an era of Al Capone, rival gangsters, jazz, flappers, bootleg booze, speakeasies, gambling joints, dirty politicians, corrupt cops, and of course, the ghosts those violent days left behind. This is episode 10 of season 10. John Torrio's Last Stand. On January 12, 1925, Capone and two of his bodyguards were driven by his chauffeur, Sylvester Barton, to a restaurant located at State and 55th Streets on the south side of Chicago. When they reached the restaurant, Capone exited the car on the passenger side. The two bodyguards exited just behind him, on the driver's side of the vehicle. Just as the door closed behind Capone, a long black car cruised slowly by. Inside the car were Northsiders, Jaime Weiss, Vincent Drucci, and George Moran, all clutching shotguns and automatics. As they rolled up next to Capone's car, the windows came down and they opened fire on Capone. Bullets slammed into metal and windows were shattered in the assault. A policeman was later quoted as saying, "They let it have everything but the kitchen stove." After a loud hail of gunfire, the Northsider's car rolled away. Capone managed to come out of it without a scratch, and even the two bodyguards were unscathed. The driver, Sylvester Barton, though, was hit once in the back. Barton survived the attack, but Capone knew how close the call had been. So he decided to place a special order with General Motors, a $30,000 custom-built limousine that weighed over 7 tons. It had a steel armor-plated body, a steel hooded gas tank, bulletproof windows, a gun compartment behind the rear seat, and a removable back window that allowed occupants to open fire on pursuing vehicles. Capone was soon using the car regularly. Even when traveling short distances, he knew he was an easy target walking down the sidewalk. When he had to cross a street or even a hotel lobby, a cluster of bodyguards surrounded him with 2 or 3 men on every side. No strangers were allowed to sit at adjacent tables in the nightclubs he patronized. At the opera, bodyguards took the seats on every side. In his office, he used a swivel chair with a high armor-plated back as a precaution against an assassin that might somehow slip past his guards. He rarely kept an appointment at the agreed-upon time and place, always sending a messenger ahead to change the time and location. Ironically, despite all these precautions, no life insurance company would sell him a policy, as he found out when he tried to get insured in 1925. While Sylvester Barton recovered from his bullet wound, Capone used Tommy Rossi as his driver. Rossi proved to be exceptionally loyal to the boss. Not long after he started driving Capone, some of Jaime Weiss's men kidnapped him and tried to force him to tell them where they might ambush Capone. I'm guessing that he never talked. Why? Well, because one morning, a couple of weeks later, 2 boys were walking a horse through some woods southwest of Chicago and stopped at a water cistern so the animal could get a drink. But the horse got spooked, quickly backing away from the water. There was nothing they could do to get the horse to drink and finally gave up. Later that day, the boys mentioned the odd incident to a police officer they knew. He instructed the boys to take him back to the cistern. He looked inside and immediately called for backup. Within an hour, cops were hauling out what was left of Tommy Rossi. He'd been tied up, beaten, and burned with cigarettes before being shot 5 times in the head. His killers had tried to hide the body by using wire to attach him to a concrete block and dropping him into the isolated cistern. But he'd been found by sheer luck. But he hadn't talked, and Capone hadn't had any near misses since earlier in January. John Torrio, though, wouldn't be so lucky. In mid-January, John and Ann Torrio returned to Chicago. Torrio had been out on bail for 7 months, but now he and 11 co-defendants had to stand trial for the Sebin Brewery incident. Even though he was dead, Dino Banyan was still causing trouble. Torrio, though, was almost happy to be in a courtroom because he knew it was a safe place to hide from Jaime Weiss and his gunmen. Torrio was shaken by the recent attempt to kill Capone, and he was looking for a place to hide. He was trying to decide what would be the safest place for him to go and finally realized it would be federal prison. So on January 23rd, when Torrio appeared before federal judge Adam Cliff, he entered a guilty plea in his case. He would be safely behind bars, and by the time he got out, he was sure that Capone would have dealt with Jaime Weiss. Before he passed sentence, Judge Cliff offered Torrio 5 days to settle his affairs, and on January 24th, Torrio took his wife shopping on Michigan Avenue. His car was in the shop for repair, so he borrowed a Lincoln sedan from Jake Guzik, who offered the use of his driver, Robert Barton, who was the brother of Sylvester Barton, who'd recently been shot driving Capone. It was almost dusk when the automobile, packed with shopping bags and parcels, turned onto Clyde Avenue on Chicago's south side. It stopped in front of 7011, where the Torrios occupied a large apartment on the 3rd floor. As the car came to a halt, neither Barton nor the Torrios noticed the black Cadillac with no license plates parked at the corner of Clyde and 70th Street. Barton got out. opened the sedan's rear door and helped the Torrios gather their bags. And Torrio went ahead along the short sidewalk leading to the door in the center of the apartment building. The Cadillac slowly moved forward. Anne pushed the door open, backing into the building since her hands were full. She now noticed the black Cadillac. It had stopped across the street, directly alongside the borrowed sedan. She could see what appeared to be four men inside the car and quickly realized that all of them were holding guns. Anne screamed just as her husband climbed out of the car and stepped onto the sidewalk, but her warning came too late. She watched helplessly as two men, later determined to be George Moran and Jaime Weiss, threw open the doors of the Cadillac and jumped out. They had automatics in their hands and ran toward Torrio. Alerted by the sound of the doors, Torrio started to turn, but he moved too slow. Moran fired first, two shots, and Torrio fell to the ground, his jaw broken by one bullet and struck in the chest by the second. As he went down, a third bullet, this one fired by Weiss, hit him in the arm. A fourth bullet struck his groin. As Torrio was falling to the sidewalk, the two men still in the Cadillac, Vincent Drucci and Frank Gusenberg, opened fire at the sedan with shotguns, shattering the windows and punching holes in the metal. Robert Barton was struck once in the leg and fell next to the car. By now, Moran had reached the spot where Torrio fell and he bent over him, pressing the muzzle of his automatic to the fallen man's head. He planned to deliver a fatal shot, but when he squeezed the trigger, the gun jammed. Before he could clear it, Drucci began honking the horn of the Cadillac, signaling furiously they needed to leave. Moran and Weiss ran to the car, and they sped away. Somehow, Torrio started crawling toward the apartment building, leaving a trail of blood behind him on the pavement. Anne, who was screaming, managed to drag him inside. A neighbor, Mrs. James Putnam, had witnessed the shooting and had already called the nearby Woodlawn police station. When an ambulance arrived a few minutes later, Torrio was raced to Jackson Park Hospital. He was in bad shape, but was awake and talking as he was loaded into the ambulance. Torrio could have gotten to the hospital faster in the borrowed sedan, but Robert Barton was already gone. Bleeding, he'd limped back into the car and sped off toward 71st Street. He raced past a car driven by a retired detective sergeant named Thomas Conley, who, spotting a sedan filled with bullet holes, gave chase. He confronted Barton in a drugstore just as he was stumbling out of a telephone booth. The bleeding man refused to tell Connolly what was going on. He pushed past him, got back into the car, and drove off again. After traveling halfway across the city, he was finally forced to pull over by a patrol car, taken to a local station house, and then to the hospital. The person that Barton had telephoned, the police later believed, was Al Capone. Several bodyguards had already been dispatched to Torrio's bedside, but had to fight their way through reporters to get there. The newsmen were already badgering the badly wounded but still conscious man with questions. Torrio spoke with great difficulty thanks to his damaged face, but managed to say, quote, "Sure, I know all four men, but I'll never tell their names." And he never did. The police had been able to find someone to talk, though. The 17-year-old son of the apartment building's janitor, Peter Visard. He'd been standing in the doorway of the building at the time of the attack. He was shown some photographs taken by the police during Dino Banyan's funeral, and he pointed out George Moran as the first man who shot Torrio. Bravely, he insisted his identification was correct, even when he was face-to-face with Moran after he was arrested. "You're the man," Peter said. The police wanted to hold Moran until they could establish evidence supporting the boy's identification, but Judge William Lindsay released him under $5,000 bond. Not long after, Peter Visart resigned from his job as the apartment building's caretaker, and the family moved out of town. They never returned. And needless to say, George Moran was never charged with the shooting. Al Capone had made it to Jackson Park Hospital soon after the ambulance arrived. He was in tears when he learned that his friend's condition was critical. He refused to leave Torrio's bedside and insisted that Torrio be given an inner room on the top floor. Two policemen stood on guard outside Torrio's door, but Capone also placed four bodyguards in the corridor. It turned out these precautions were necessary. During the night, hospital staff reported three carloads of armed men had circled the building. The police were notified, and eventually, the cars drove off and didn't return. Despite the seriousness of his wounds, Torrio recovered quickly. In less than 3 weeks, he was discharged from the hospital after being shot four times. He left by way of a hidden fire escape, surrounded by bodyguards. That same day, February 9th, with his jaw and face bandaged and hidden behind a scarf, he appeared again before Judge Cliff. He was ordered to pay a $5,000 fine and sentenced to spend 9 months at the Lake County Jail in Waukegan, Illinois. Aware of the danger that Torrio was in, the jail's warden fitted the windows of Torrio's cell with bulletproof mesh steel blinds and assigned two deputy wardens to patrol the corridor outside of his cell. Other additions to his private quarters had nothing to do with Torrio's safety. It was outfitted with Persian rugs, an easy chair, wall pictures, and a down mattress for the bunk. Believe it or not, this was not unheard of treatment for wealthy, well-connected prisoners, especially in Chicago. The warden also allowed Torrio to hold business conferences at the jail, and in March, a month after he began his stay, he met with Capone and his attorneys. The treaties between the gangs that Torrio had created and worked so hard to enforce were now wrecked beyond recovery. There was no hope of peace in the Chicago underworld, and Torrio had no stomach for war. So he announced to Capone and his lawyers that he planned to retire from Chicago and divest himself of all of his interests in the city. He made no demands, asked for no payments, and had no conditions when he turned everything over to Capone. He simply gave him his full share of the business they'd been operating together. All the breweries, distilleries, speakeasies, brothels, and gambling houses, all of which produced an annual revenue in the tens of millions of dollars. Al Capone was now the king of the Chicago underworld and the most powerful man in the city at the age of only 26 years old. But the new empire did come with a price. With the syndicate crumbling, it was all in danger of coming apart. To secure it again and continue building wealth, Capone had to win back, overthrow, or destroy every major gang in Chicago. Capone had been on the defensive since the murder of Dean O'Banion, so it was now time to strike back, a decision that ensured that Chicago would never be the same again. Thanks for listening to this episode of American Hauntings, and we hope you'll stay tuned for the postmortem section of the episode. It's coming up right after these messages from our sponsors. Ready for a little more American Hauntings this week? Well, we're back with the postmortem, the part of the show after the show, where we sharpen our knives and dissect the episode. My name is Troy Taylor. I'm the guy who narrates and writes the show. And across from me is my friend, co-host, partner in crime, and consigliere, Cody the Nose Beck.
The nose knows. Troy, I can tell you right now, it's one of those like sunny days where it's still raining a whole bunch and like storms are coming in, but it's still really sunny, and so it kind of makes you wonder, like, I know it's the good and the bad at the same time. But and it's also like really humid outside. It's I mean, we're in early June, you know?
I
So
know,
that's
I
kind of
know.
what's gonna happen. And
Yeah,
it's just
yeah.
been
And
it's
it's been a weird time lately anyway.
it has.
Things have been super hectic. The cat is at the vet. Loki is near
Oh.
death for like the eighth time.
Is he
So
okay?
this
So
is like
far so
his
good
eighth
or
life.
oh.
Well,
Oh, so
they
you got
think
one
it's
more?
pancreatitis.
Pancreatic
And so
cancer.
he's not eating. No, it's not cancer or anything, but he's not eating. He's been
Oh,
sick.
I'm
And
so
so he's
sorry.
at the vet so he can have like 3 days of IV inject, you know, medicine and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're heading toward the you know, a four-figure vet bill. So it's,
Right.
you know, things have been it's been a weird time. So,
Can I tell
yeah.
you something also? Well, first off, I'm very sorry about that, but also the other day, I live in Edwardsville. I'll just let people know, and I was turning.
And this is his address. Text me. I'll give it to you. No, I'm just
I
kidding.
was living by. I'm sorry. I was turning by the Edwardsville Library and the CVS, and I was turning left toward Main Street, and this dog ran down the street. And in between my car and another car, and it had a leash on and a collar on and everything. And
Uh-oh.
I was at a red light. I was like, what the hell happened? And I got out of my car, and another guy got out of his car, and we tried to grab the dog, but it was moving too fast, and we were way too out of shape. I mean, honestly, and then we see up a street ahead, there was some commotion or something. And we both decided, turn left and do our thing. And I learned later that this dog's name was Oliver, and Oliver, their owner had been hit by a car. So
Oh, God.
somebody was this person was walking the dog. Oliver got hit. Dog ran away. Me and this person jumped out, a minute after, couldn't catch the dog. And it's been 6 or 7 days since they could figure out what's going on with Oliver, and everywhere I go around me, I see signs about protecting Oliver and getting Oliver and all that. They
Well, I'm not
find
surprised somebody was hit in Edwardsville. God, it's
they
terrible traffic there and stuff,
but
man.
they finally found Oliver today. But the thing
Good.
is, I hate it so much. But his leash, he was wrapped around a tree in the woods.
Oh, man.
Because he had his leash, but they found Oliver. Everything's good, and
That's good.
Oliver's good. I felt so bad that I didn't dive down to grab the dog, but
Or she
Oliver's
probably wouldn't
good.
have been able to get back up. So,
A hundred percent, I would not have been able to get
at
back
least there
up.
was an ambulance close by. You could have ridden to the hospital
But yeah,
with his
but
owner.
the
So,
thing that's been irking me the most lately has been about this dog, and I'm like, I should have done more, but they found him, so it's
well, good
okay.
deal.
So that's what's going on. But yeah, anyway, so that's fine. Do we want to talk about other things that are coming up that are also fine?
Sure. This
Great
coming Friday,
transition.
this co yeah, right. This coming Friday is the only Ghost of the River Road tour that I'm doing this summer. That is a dinner tour. It travels from Alton to Grafton on the Great River Road. We've had some other dinner tours, but this is the only Ghost of the River Road tour. So, we've got like 10 spots left for it. So if you're interested, go to the website, go to dinnerandspirits.com and check it out because it's going to be the only one of those we're going to offer. Then a week later on the 19th, I'm doing a haunted downtown pub crawl. We had
Nice.
one this past weekend, which was a blast. We
No
had
shit.
probably one of the nicest. I mean, we've had pretty good groups of people for the most part, but regular, do you have everyone on the tour who's awesome? You know, it's always like a great group or whatever, you know, like I think I told you about the ladies hockey team that I had.
Oh,
Yeah, and they
yes.
were fantastic. And then, you know, other people were too. But this particular one we had, like everybody on the tour was just great.
I'm so sad
Oh, it
I
was
can't do
so
the
much
pub crawls
fun.
with you all, but I'm
Yeah.
so happy you all have a good time.
Yeah,
Like
it is a
that's
lot of
great.
fun. So that's on the 19th. And then on the 20th, I'm doing the last Devil Came to St. Louis for a while. I won't be doing another one until August.
Oh, you
And
expecting fire alarms or anything?
well, no, not necessarily, but we are not serving dinner at this one. So it's a bargain
Ah, okay.
price.
Okay.
It's just for people want to come, they can the come. We'll still have the concession stand open.
That sounds great.
There may or may not be a speakeasy operating nearby. But we will have it. It'll still be a full night. And people still get, an hour admission to the museum
Sure,
beforehand.
yeah.
So it all comes with the regular stuff, just no dinner on that one. So anyway, check out the website for those events and for other stuff we've got coming up. We've got all of our summer stuff up there, and it won't be long. We'll be posting fall events too. Well, and speaking of pub crawls, you might still want to make one of them this year.
Do you think?
Because in late October, we will be offering a zombie pub crawl, which I used to do in Chicago,
Oh
and we
my
have not
gosh.
done it down here. And so that is something we're going to be doing in late October. So you might want to come to that one.
You think
But
I can come? Can I dress as a zombie?
you, yeah, that's what we'll all be doing. That's the whole point of
Oh,
the
that's the
zombie
whole
pub crawl.
point.
Everybody comes as a zombie.
I
So it is a lot of
gotcha.
fun. But anyway, you can check out these upcoming events at dinnerandspirits.com. And of course, the other thing that we have coming up 2.5 weeks away now, actually 2 weeks until the deadline, is the Haunted America Conference.
Troy, I
We
can't
are
even.
down to the end of the line here.
Oh
I mean,
my gosh.
it is the last chance. We have 2 weeks, less than 2 weeks now, to get signed up. You do not want to miss this thing. We have a great group of people coming this year, speakers and presenters, plus great attendees. Our numbers are way up over last year, and we've got a
No
great
shit.
location for it at Lewis and Clark College. And we were just there meeting the other day, laying out all the vendor tables and where everybody's going to be. And we have put you and Adam right next to us so
What?
that I
I
can
was
keep an
saying,
eye
what?
on
You
you.
didn't even call you yeah, you didn't even call me to let me know where I was gonna be. I
Yeah,
show up
well, you'll
every day
find
and
out when
Troy
you get
just
there.
puts me in a table.
Yeah, but you're close by. You're close to us. You're between you're next to Oren and us. Where are my area will be, Oren will be next door to you guys.
I'm
So
down to be with Oren and Adam. I didn't necessarily want to be by you, but like, no,
yeah,
that's
well,
fine.
you
That's
are
fine.
because I've got to watch over all of my kids. So that's how I feel.
Can I say to Troy that I do so every year I will ask people to tell me their ghost stories,
Sure.
and it's usually pretty much like, hey, come tell me a 3 to 4 minute ghost story.
Yeah,
You know, they sit
yeah.
down, put the cans on,
And then it's an hour later.
and it's an hour later. Yeah, but
No.
Troy, I'm gonna do something different. You don't even know about this yet.
Okay.
I'm gonna do something different. I think whoever tells me the best short ghost story this year, I think I'm gonna give them a good prize. I think I'm gonna give
Okay.
them, I don't know what it's
You
gonna
mean more
be.
than the sticker? Because we've got a sticker that says you told a ghost story, and
Okay,
we will make
so
sure that you have them. So,
Troy, I'm letting you know right now, it's gonna be better than the sticker.
okay, all
And
right, cool.
somebody this year that tells me the best ghost story is gonna get some kind of good prize. I don't know what it's gonna
All
be
right,
yet. It's gonna be
okay,
maybe a shirt, maybe a book, maybe
cool,
two stickers. I don't know, but
but
hey,
it'll be a prize,
if you
yeah.
come up, if you come up and you sit down with
Well,
me and
everybody
you tell
tells one
me a
gets the
ghost story.
sticker. So if it's the
Oh
best
yeah,
one,
the
they'll get
sticker.
something else.
Yeah, you might get two stickers, but no. But yeah, everybody gets the sticker, absolutely. But if you tell me the what I'm gonna just randomly judge as the best ghost story, objectively, guess you're gonna get something nice. So please come tell me a
All
ghost
right.
story.
Okay.
You know?
Sounds good. Yeah. Sounds good.
Heck
All
yeah.
right, well, let's see. You got some new Patreon supporters
I do have
list for
some
us?
new Patreon supporters. So one quick, I just wanted to say thank you very much for supporting the show to Maria, Cara, Charity, Amanda, and Ben. So thank you very much for supporting the show. You should get good stuff shortly at some point in the mail. Oh, also, somebody emailed me, I can't remember who it is, about not getting their their level of Patreon shirt yet just for joining.
Yep.
I promise you I will handle that this weekend. And that's the thing, if you sign up for certain levels of Patreon, you are going to get either one shirt or six shirts throughout
Right,
the
yeah, you
year.
never know. Yeah, I mean, people have, I mean, we offer special discounts, advanced sales, the shirts, as Cody mentioned. It just depends on what level of supporter you are. But we
Yes.
will tell you that anything over the $5 or over has access to all six full seasons of our Patreon podcast. We do a
Yes.
separate podcast called Dead Men Do Tell Tales.
Yes.
And it's usually a single story from American history.
It's
And
usually really
we're
gross.
it's usually gruesome. I tend to they're the kind of things that we'd have to censor if we put them on the main line. So
Yeah.
they're pretty grim. And the season that we just started, we're on next week will be episode three of season seven, which is called Holy Terror, which is murder, mayhem, and the only Catholic priest ever sentenced to death.
Yes.
And for some pretty awful things.
Yes.
Yeah, so we're working on that now. And so the next episode will be coming out next Tuesday. So we encourage you, if you want to take part in supporting the podcast and getting all the extra stuff and also getting this other podcast, get signed up now. You can do that at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. So,
Yes. All
yeah.
right. Well, hey, are you ready to dive into
I am ready. It's
this
a
last stand?
it is a somewhat short episode. We know this. The
Yes.
issue that I had was that the next part of the story is considerably longer. So we either had a short episode or we had an episode that was so long that
I think
no
you made
one
the
could
right
listen to the
call.
entire thing.
I think you
So
made the right
yeah,
call.
it had a natural stopping spot. So that is what I decided to do.
It
So,
did.
yeah.
It did. So this is John Torrio's last stand, but it's also like Capone gets capped but doesn't die.
Yeah, it's kind of what happens next. Everything that happened after Dino Banyan was killed, as I mentioned last week, I mean, once they killed him, they just opened themselves up for like this vendetta,
Yeah,
essentially,
right?
that began from the Northsiders against Capone, well, and Torrio.
Well, that's the thing. Like, wouldn't you? I mean, is it them getting too cocky, too much of an ego? Like, don't they understand? Like, we need this balance kind of thing
Well,
going
these guys don't
on.
care. As far as they were concerned, Capone and Torrio's operation had killed not only their leader, but you got to remember when we first talked about this, especially the Northside Gang, these guys were like family. They were best friends. I mean, some of them had been, O'Banion and say George Moran had been committing crimes together since they were kids. So he'd known these guys for a long time and they were fiercely loyal to him. And so everything came, I mean, while they were continuing to operate their business, they were, also engaged in this revenge plot against Torrio and Capone. I mean, they wanted them dead. And that's what really started this, what became known as the Beer Wars in Chicago, but it became really bad. I mean, completely different than how it had been before. I mean, there had been violence, obviously, but not like this.
I mean, it's basically, I mean, it's the revenue, the profit wars at this point, right?
Oh,
Kind of like
sure,
I
absolutely. I mean, yes, it's about business, but for the Northsiders, it was personal. I mean, they lived and breathed their business anyway, but man, they really wanted revenge.
Oh man, I'm trying to think. So if I'm in this situation, I'm making money, but
Okay, think of it this way. Remember in The Godfather? Remember in The Godfather when they tried to take out when they tried to take out the Godfather, and then they just went after everybody from there.
Anybody and
And
everybody.
yeah, exactly. And did it became a point where, as the war continues, as it will, they went to the mattresses, as so to speak.
They went to
In Godfather speak, they went to the mattresses, which means that all the
is
gunmen were
yes.
called in on duty and everybody was ready to kill or be killed at all times.
So is this like a regime change, essentially? But with like words?
That's coming. Now,
okay.
at this point, it's still revenge. They really, they're not trying to take over Capone's operation. They're just trying to wipe out Torrio and Capone, who they held responsible for the murder of their friend.
That's the thing I'm trying to think of. Is
see, you're trying to make this more all about business. And you got to understand that with Drucci and Jaime Weiss and Moran and most of the Northsiders, it wasn't about business. This is completely personal.
It was personal.
I mean, yeah, I mean, sure, they'll take their business, but they really just want revenge at this point. You know, it's Capone who's the one who's more worried about business. And that's kind of sets things up at the end of this episode for next time as to how things were unraveling, because they were. They start to unravel after all this. After Torrio turns things over to Capone, things really start to come apart.
I think, Troy, that's where I would fail, because I'd be like, I am trying to make this more about business.
Yeah, well, right. I think what you're saying is you're looking at this in a business way, and that's really the correct way to look at it. These guys are unhinged. I mean, they were all a little wacky anyway, but their grief has unhinged them. And so, I mean, remember Louis Altieri putting, you know, in the newspaper talking about how he wanted to challenge Torrio and Capone to a gunfight in the middle of State Street.
Right.
I mean, these guys are crazy. And so they just want to kill Capone. That's all. That's what they want. And they want to kill Capone, and they want to take out Torrio, which, you know, effectively they do. But, you know, the first thing that happens, of course, you know, Torrio leaves town wisely, you know, goes on a vacation, not knowing that he's being stalked the entire time. Again, you know, these guys are crazy. So Jaime Weiss has sent gunmen to follow Torrio and his wife all over the South.
Yes.
And into the Caribbean. I mean, they were going to take, I mean, they would have taken them out in the Bahamas if they could.
100%.
Yeah, they didn't care where. They just wanted to get him, and they could never keep up, you know, never managed to do it. I mean, you got to remember, it's a different time. You're talking about, you know, 1925, so getting from place to place, lots slower than it is now. It's not like they're like, oh, we heard he was going to the Bahamas. We'll hop a plane and get there before he does. You're going to take a slow boat to the Bahamas, because that's the only way to get there.
Well, you even said Al Capone was now the king of Chicago underworld and the most powerful man in the city at the age of 26 years old. Troy, I was... That was 10 years ago for me. That was 58 years ago for you. Like, how?
No, I don't think that's quite right, but it's close.
But holy shit. Imagine...
I mean, in 1925, I was already in my teens.
That's true. But no, imagine being 26 years old and being in charge of anything.
I shouldn't have been in charge of anything at 26, although I had already, you know, had...
Well, being 26 years old and being in charge of anything, especially like this, like, how dumb were you at 26? I was really dumb at 26.
Yeah, me too. Like, I would not have been running an entire, you know, gangland operation.
Underworld, yeah.
Yeah, with hundreds of guys working for me and knowing that I could be shot at and killed at any time, because I had guys who hated me who were trying to hunt me down, which is exactly what led to the, you know, the $30,000, you know, automobile that he bought, you know, because after that close call, you know, he bought this limousine that weighed over 7 tons. Can you imagine how the streets, I mean, I know how the streets in Chicago are now. Imagine how they were in 1925.
Garbage.
This thing must have been just like thudding its way along through everywhere like a tank, you know.
It
must have been riding, like riding in an armored vehicle of some kind.
This is all so bad. And also, like we said, way younger than we would be to deal with, like, to have this much pressure, I guess, or
It is a lot. It was a lot of pressure. And, you know, it was never, I don't think it was ever supposed to be. I mean, he never thought that he would be the only one in charge. He counted on Torrio to be his mentors.
His mentor,
but he also considered him his balance. He balanced out Capone. You know, I mean, Torrio approached things in a certain way, very methodical, very businesslike.
Yeah.
Well, Capone would be like, I hate that guy. Let's go kill him. And Torrio would be like, no. That's going to mess up business. And so now you've got this guy who's, you know, in charge. And that's why things get so bloody. Well, that and the Northsiders are crazy and they want revenge. And so now you've got, hair triggers on both sides.
I don't blame the Northsiders for being so crazy.
No, like, I don't either.
I'd probably do the same damn thing. Like, let's go.
I get it.
Oh, man. Okay. Is there anything we didn't talk about yet?
No, I mean, you know, it's, I think I covered it pretty well.
There's a lot we could talk about. What happened
to Torrio? There was a lot of action there, you know, with what happened. And I've been to that apartment. I mean, to the apartment building where it happened. I mean, it's one of those places I needed to check out, you know. And it's still a nice building. It must have been really nice in the 20s.
Is this different than the Candyman stuff? Like,
No, it's not anything like. No, this is a nice place. I mean, this guy had a shit ton of money.
Not no projects. So, this is
no. It's an apartment building, but. Even like, I've been to like Dino Banyan's where his apartment building, it's like a U-shaped building and it's really ornate still to this day. So
these guys
were spending big money on apartments. It's like now when you buy apartments in Chicago, you know, not everybody rents, they buy the apartments.
They're buying.
And that's what these guys were doing. They were paying big money buildings.
Got it.
And, you know, he and his wife had the top floor. Of the building,
the penthouse third floor. Shit.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, it's 20 steps from the curb to the door. So, I mean, they must have come up really fast.
Yeah.
And just started shooting and, and took him down. But the fact that he survived, I mean, he was hit four times.
That's
and he was not young and not a big guy. I mean,
that's a lot of hits, dude.
It is
for anyone.
And, and survived the way. I mean, he was hit in the face. I mean, it shattered his jaw.
Ugh.
You know, so there are photos of him when he went to court soon after, when he got out of the hospital.
Yeah.
And he's wearing like a scarf around his neck, and he's got it pulled up kind of high, so you can't see the damage that was done.
Shut up, dude.
Yeah.
Come on.
So But so he goes to jail for a few months and pretty much, moves into, a place with an easy chair and rugs and a bed. And the warden's letting him, keep running his business and stuff. And
Really? Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Finally, after about a month after he was there, he invites Capone and his attorneys in so that he can, turn everything over to Capone. The syndicate that he built, that he tried to enforce was just wrecked by this point.
Yeah.
And so he was done. He knew there was no hope for peace. He didn't want to be involved in a war that he knew was coming. So he just told Capone
that he was losing.
I'm done. And here's everything.
Yeah.
He didn't ask for it. I mean, he had plenty of money. He asked for no demands. He didn't ask him to buy anything from him.
Sure.
Nothing. He just turned everything over and just gave him his share
of
all the business, which, as I mentioned, was, tens of millions of dollars every year.
Damn, dude.
And Torrio wanted to live more than he wanted money. So he just kind of turned everything over to Capone.
Imagine, out
of jail, he'll go to Italy for a while.
Imagine, building all that up and then just being like, here,
yeah,
you can take
I'm
it.
Done.
Like,
yeah, I'm sure his wife helped convince him.
His wife was pretty much like, if you don't stop this shit.
Right. I mean, they had a really good marriage. And as so many of these gangsters did. And so she, knew what her husband did, but, talked about remember they talked about what a great family man he was. Right. Exactly. Yes. So I'm sure she kind of leaned on him a bit and said, this is probably not our best bet if you'd like to get old with me.
I think at some point, if I was doing really bad stuff and Brooke was like, hey, either stop this or it's gonna, you know, be the end of the world. I'd be like, you know what? I'll toss it off and okay, babe, let's go.
Yeah, we've got millions of dollars already, so yeah. I'm not gonna worry about yeah. what I might
go,
have earned.
I'll go
because I
that.
Probably would end up dead. So yeah. I'm sure that's where
we'll
that
go buy a bigger
bed
from. With our $10 million and we'll just let yeah. everything else go and yeah. but yeah, hey, did I miss anything? Is there anything else
I don't think
talk
so,
over?
No, I don't think so. Unless there's some other question you've got.
I think it's about that time.
Yeah, as you said, not a long episode. It's just it's an action episode. Next time we'll get more into what happens next.
Yes,
because things are really coming apart.
I know that
are going to get very bloody.
I know the next episode is going to get very bloody. That's what I'm
yes.
excited about.
Yeah, it was a trans. This was a transition.
Yeah, episode, you'll have to read Troy's books because I'm telling you, I know that the next episode is about to get really upsetting.
Yeah. It's going to get there. So, and not that, you know, the guy found in the cistern is already upsetting.
Oh, no, yeah. No, not at all.
No, you know, no, can you imagine?
No,
can you imagine being those kids?
Can you imagine? You know,
what is that?
Can you imagine finding a body in a cistern, that being upsetting compared to what we're about to talk about?
Well, yeah, good point. Good point. So,
anyway. You want to take us out or no, sorry. I'm so sorry. Well, I don't have any ghostwriter stuff. If you guys have any questions or comments about the World of Macabre, you can email us at American Hauntings Podcast at gmail.com. But I don't have anything right now, but I bet you have some.
Well,
stuff
I actually line. Had a couple of haunt line questions.
Let's talk
that
about
them. Answered or delved into, but I do have one more that I wanted to talk about because it was an interesting question and uh-huh. I thought that people might enjoy it. And I said, hey, Troy and Cody, hope you're both doing well. Here's a story about my bootlegging great-grandfather. I was hoping Troy could confirm. Vito Gianola apparently had a thing for my great aunt and he took her hostage. My great-grandfather, her brother, went to her rescue and shot Vito in the process. It's been said that he dropped the gun there because that's what they did back then. Science now eliminates being able to do that kind of thing, obviously, but was that a common practice or just a family rumor? That is was a very common practice.
Sorry, then. Troy, can you walk me through this? I shooting somebody, dropping a gun. I'm confused now. Can you walk me
okay,
through
so
this context? Okay,
so she said that her she had a great grandfather who was a bootlegger, and uh-huh. there was another gangster who was a rival gangster, I assume, Vito Gianola, and he had kidnapped her great grandfather's sister because he had
okay.
a thing for her.
Okay.
And so her great grandfather went after him, uh-huh. found them both, uh-huh. shot Vito to death, rescued his sister,
yep.
and then just dropped the gun at the scene.
Got it.
And so the question was whether or not this was a common practice, because now, of course,
that's what I would do before fingerprints.
Well, fingerprints and DNA and that kind of stuff. But back then, the best thing to do would be drop the gun, because most yeah. likely. He killed him with what we, you know, would term now as a throwaway.
Yeah.
Which was an extra gun that a lot of gangsters or even cops carried just in case.
So it's drop the gun, take the cannoli now.
Right, exactly. Well, yeah. Well, no. He said leave the gun, take the cannoli.
Oh, sorry.
See, that's,
sorry.
So that's no. That's just thanks for misquoting The Godfather. Because
God damn it.
If you quoted it correctly, it would exactly make my point.
Yeah,
you know,
so hey, we'll
take the
Cody. We'll,
so
Cody,
you
we'll
drop
edit
the gun.
We'll edit this out, Cody, and we'll
no, he won't.
Replace it.
No, he won't. So anyway, that was very common because you might not have your fingerprints tracked. You know, obviously, there was no DNA to check, but they could check the caliber of the gun or at least check the bullets on
got
the gun
it.
And see what had fired it. And then if you get caught with that gun, then you're in big trouble. So it was a lot easier to just toss the throwaway.
Well,
because
they have one of three things that's pretty much the caliber, like you're saying. So yeah, you might as well just fucking toss it, get
yeah.
rid of it.
And... yeah, because then that way you can't ever be connected to that gun.
Exonerate. Yeah,
there's
yeah.
no way to connect you to it. So
wow.
that I think, although they were doing fingerprinting by the 20s, but
right,
still,
right.
it was still, there weren't a lot of people in a database back then. You know,
sure.
I mean, you could... you know, the people who were arrested might be fingerprinted, but I mean, anybody could have shot
yeah.
someone. So just leaving the gun behind at the scene was very common.
Wow.
Yeah. You might remember going back to The Godfather again, because
I'm going to get
that's
quote
where
wrong.
We get so much of our, you know, our knowledge or beliefs about how the mob worked. You know, you might remember when Michael gets the gun from the back of the toilet and shoots McCluskey.
Yes.
And then leaves the gun, drops the gun on the floor and walks away. So, that is not just a family rumor, just so you know. I don't know. This one came to us from the 314. So it's a St. Louis, you know, number.
Uh-oh. Yeah.
So that is not just a family story. That is absolutely the way it was done.
Wow.
So whatever family member told you that story, they were not pulling your leg. So
I guess at this point, Troy, what's more damning? It would be the ballistics or the fingerprints, I would imagine.
Yeah, or the DNA now. I mean, you know, there's so many different ways that you can identify somebody now that you couldn't in the 1920s.
Yeah.
So, you know, just tossing the gun behind was pretty common practice.
Yeah, I think you and I, when we kill people in the future, you and I need to figure out better ways, because we keep tossing guns and
oh, well, yeah. Yeah, I mean, back then, I just always toss my gun.
Exactly.
Leave it there at the spot.
I used to just cut my fingers off, so we gotta stop. We got to stop.
A little acid on our finger.
Yeah, you know.
A little Dillinger, you know, burn off my fingerprints.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, you have more text messages.
Nope, that's it for today. So
that's
if you guys want to text us on the hotline, I already had answered a few of them. So things had already been taken care of on a couple of questions that needed a quicker response. So, but if you do want to text us any questions or comments about the show, text us or this show or American Nightmares or whatever, text us at 217-791-7859 and you may get read on the show. So thanks very much. Are you ready to wrap it up?
I am ready to rock and roll.
Okay, thanks again for checking out the story and the postmortem for this week's episode of American Hauntings, which is part of the American Hauntings Podcast Network. We hope you'll give all of our shows a try, the current ones and the ones that are still coming. And if you love them as much as we love making them, you'll tell other people about them and encourage them to listen. If you get a chance, leave us a review wherever you do listen, which makes it easier for others to find us. And to say thanks for your support, we've got a discount code that's just one word, podcast, and that gives you 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from our online store at AmericanHauntings.net. You'll also find a link there to Cody's shirt store where you can use the same discount. That store is AmericanHauntingsClothing.com. As just remember, this podcast is not the only thing we offer. American Hauntings is also books, tours, ghost hunts, dinner events, the Haunted America Conference, and the American Oddities Museum in Alton, Illinois. While that makes the company sound big, we are just a small business that is always grateful for your support, and more so than you could possibly know.
I think this is the, second to last episode we're going to have come out before the conference?
Yeah, we should have one
I think
more.
We have, yes. Well, one more.
One more.
I did want to remind people that I'm going to be recording ghost stories from participants that can come up at the conference.
You did mention that earlier.
I did. Okay. I just wanted to, I wanted to
talked about prizes. Oh, okay. Sorry.
I wanted to,
I thought maybe you had blacked out and didn't remember that you'd mentioned it.
Yeah,
already.
No, not blacked out.
Sorry.
I wanted to remind them. anyway, because this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor and is produced and edited by Cody Beck. That's me. All right, change.
And interrupted by Troy Taylor.
And interrupted by, to find out more about the show, check out the show notes or go to our website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. You can find out more about the podcast network there, or you can reach out to us with comments, questions, suggestions, and complaints, okay, via email or by text at the hotline.
Well, I mean, you know.
I mean, I'm not. You know,
why not?
You know what? Yeah. Why not? You can also sometimes find us on social media where we post stories and updates on Facebook and Instagram. Thanks again. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
We'll see you later.
All right.
All right, cool.
Is it done raining over there? It's definitely done raining over here.
I guess. I didn't even know it was raining. I've been a moment.
This episode was brought to you by the American Hauntings Podcast Network.